Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Chapter 22 of The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Dark Nebula. Years melted into the past, centuries, eons. The light of the incandescent star sank to a furious red. It was later that I saw the Dark Nebula. At first an impalpable cloud away to my right. It grew steadily to a clot of blackness in the night. How long I watched, it is impossible to say. For time, as we count it, was a thing of the past. It came closer, a shapeless monstrosity of darkness, tremendous. It seemed to slip across the night, sleepily, a very hell fog. Slowly it slid nearer and passed into the void between me and the central suns. It was as though a curtain had been drawn before my vision. A strange tremor of fear took me, and a fresh sense of wonder. The green twilight that had reigned for so many millions of years had now given place to impenetrable gloom. Motionless, I peered about me. A century fled, and it seemed to me that I detected occasional dull glows of red passing me at intervals. Earnestly I gazed, and presently seemed to see circular masses that showed muddily red within the clouded blackness. They appeared to be growing out of the nebulous murk. A while, and they became plainer to my accustomed vision. I could see them now, with a fair amount of distinctness, ruddy-tinged spheres, similar in size to the luminous globes that I had seen so long previously. They floated past me, continually. Gradually a peculiar uneasiness seized me. I became aware of a growing feeling of repugnance and dread. It was directed against those passing orbs, and seemed born of intuitive knowledge rather than of any real cause or reason. Some of the passing globes were brighter than others, and it was from one of these that a face looked suddenly, a face human in its outline, but so tortured with woe that I stared aghast. I had not thought there was such sorrow as I saw there. I was conscious of an added sense of pain on perceiving that the eyes which glared so wildly were sightless. A while longer I saw it. Then it had passed on into the surrounding gloom. After this I saw others, all wearing that look of hopeless sorrow and blind. A long time went by, and I became aware that I was nearer to the orbs than I had been. At this I grew uneasy, though I was less in fear of those strange globules than I had been before seeing their sorrowful inhabitants, for sympathy had tempered my fear. Later, there was no doubt but that I was being carried closer to the red spheres, and presently I floated among them. In a while I perceived one bearing down upon me. I was helpless to move from its path. In a minute it seemed it was upon me, and I was submerged in a deep red mist. This cleared, and I stared confusedly across the immense breadth of the plain of silence. It appeared just as I had first seen it. I was moving forward, steadily across its surface. Away ahead shone the vast, blood-red ring.
Author's footnote. Without doubt, the flame-edged mass of the dead central sun, seen from another dimension. End of author's footnote.
That lit the place. All around was spread the extraordinary desolation of stillness that had so impressed me during my previous wanderings across its starkness. Presently, I saw rising up into the ruddy gloom the distant peaks of the mighty amphitheatre of mountains where, untold ages before, I had been shown my first glimpse of the terrors that underlie many things, and where vast and silent, watched by a thousand mute gods, stands the replica of this house of mysteries, this house that I had seen swallowed up in that hell-fire ere the earth had kissed the sun and vanished forever. Though I could see the crests of the mountain amphitheatre, yet it was a great while before their lower portions became visible. Possibly this was due to the strange ruddy haze that seemed to cling to the surface of the plain. However, be this as it may, I saw them at last. In a still further space of time, I had come so close to the mountains that they appeared to overhang me. Presently I saw the great rift open before me, and I drifted into it, without volition on my part. Later I came out upon the breadth of the enormous arena. There, at an apparent distance of some 5 miles, stood the house, huge, monstrous, and silent, lying in the very center of that stupendous amphitheater. So far as I could see, it had not altered in any way, but looked as though it were only yesterday that I had seen it. Around, the grim, dark mountains frowned down upon me from their lofty silences. Far away to my right, away up among inaccessible peaks, loomed the enormous bulk of the great beast god. Higher I saw the hideous form of the dread goddess rising up through the red gloom thousands of fathoms above me. To the left I made out the monstrous eyeless thing, gray and inscrutable. Further off, reclining on its lofty edge, the livid ghoul shape showed, a splash of sinister color among the dark mountains. Slowly I moved out across the great arena, floating. As I went, I made out the dim forms of many other lurking horrors that peopled those supreme heights. Gradually, I neared the house, and my thoughts flashed back across the abyss of years. I remembered the dread specter of the place. A short while passed, and I saw that I was being wafted directly toward the enormous mass of that silent building. About this time, I became aware, in an indifferent sort of way, of a growing sense of numbness that robbed me of the fear which I should otherwise have felt in approaching that awesome pile. As it was, I viewed it calmly, much as a man views calamity through the haze of his tobacco smoke. In a little while, I had come so close to the house as to be able to distinguish many of the details about it. The longer I looked, the more was I confirmed in my long-ago impressions of its entire similitude to this strange house. Save in its enormous size, I could find nothing unlike. Suddenly, as I stared, a great feeling of amazement filled me. I had come opposite to that part where the outer door leading into the study is situated. There, lying right across the threshold, lay a great length of coping stone, identical save in size and color with the piece I had dislodged in my fight with the pit creatures. I floated nearer, and my astonishment increased as I noticed that the door was broken partly from its hinges precisely in the manner that my study door had been forced inward by the assaults of the swine things. The sight started a train of thoughts, and I began to trace dimly that the attack on this house might have a far deeper significance than I had hitherto imagined. I remembered how long ago, in the old earth days, I had half suspected that, in some unexplainable manner, this house in which I live was en rapport, to use a recognized term, with that other tremendous structure, away in the midst of that incomparable plain. Now, however, it began to be borne upon me that I had but vaguely conceived what the realization of my suspicion meant. I began to understand, with a more than human clearness, that the attack I had repelled was in some extraordinary manner connected with an attack upon that strange edifice. With a curious inconsequence, my thoughts abruptly left the matter to dwell wonderingly upon the peculiar material out of which the house was constructed. It was, as I have mentioned earlier, of a deep green color. Yet now that I had come so close to it, I perceived that it fluctuated at times, though slightly, glowing and fading much as do the fumes of phosphorus when rubbed upon the hand in the dark. Presently my attention was distracted from this by coming to the great entrance. Here, for the first time, I was afraid, for all in a moment the huge doors swung back, and I drifted in between them helplessly. Inside all was blackness, impalpable. In an instant I had crossed the threshold, and the great doors closed, silently shutting me in that lightless place. For a while I seemed to hang motionless, suspended amid the darkness. Then I became conscious that I was moving again, where I could not tell. Suddenly, far down beneath me, I seemed to hear a murmurous noise of swine laughter. It sank away, and the succeeding silence appeared clogged with horror. Then a door opened somewhere ahead. A white haze of light filtered through, and I floated slowly into a room that seemed strangely familiar. All at once there came a bewildering screaming noise that deafened me. I saw a blurred vista of visions flaming before my sight. My senses were dazed through the space of an eternal moment. Then my power of seeing came back to me. The dizzy, hazy feeling passed, and I saw clearly.
End of chapter 22. Recording by John Van Stan, Savannah, Georgia.
Chapter 23 of The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Pepper. I was seated in my chair, back again in this old study. My glance wandered round the room. For a minute it had a strange, quivery appearance, unreal and unsubstantial. This disappeared, and I saw that nothing was altered in any way. I looked toward the end window. The blind was up. I rose to my feet shakily. As I did so, a slight noise in the direction of the door attracted my attention. I glanced toward it. For a short instant it appeared to me that it was being closed, gently. I stared and saw that I must have been mistaken. It seemed closely shut. With a succession of efforts I trod my way to the window and looked out. The sun was just rising, lighting up the tangled wilderness of gardens. For perhaps a minute I stood and stared. I passed my hand confusedly across my forehead. Presently, amid the chaos of my senses, a sudden thought came to me. I turned quickly and called to Pepper. There was no answer, and I stumbled across the room in a quick access of fear. As I went, I tried to frame his name, but my lips were numb. I reached the table and stooped down to him, with a catching at my heart. He was lying in the shadow of the table, and I had not been able to see him distinctly from the window. Now, as I stooped, I took my breath shortly. There was no Pepper. Instead, I was reaching toward an elongated little heap of gray, ash-like dust. I must have remained in that half-stooped position for some minutes. I was dazed, stunned. Pepper had really passed into the land of shadows.
End of chapter 23. Recording by John Van Stan, Savannah, Georgia.
Chapter 24 of The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Footsteps in the Garden. Pepper is dead. Even now, at times, I seem scarcely able to realize that this is so. It is many weeks since I came back from that strange and terrible journey through space and time. Sometimes in my sleep I dream about it and go through in my imagination the whole of that fearsome happening. When I wake, my thoughts dwell upon it. That sun, those suns,
were they indeed the great central suns round which the whole universe of the unknown heavens revolves? Who shall say? And the bright globules floating forever in the light of the green sun, and this sea of sleep on which they float, how unbelievable it all is. If it were not for Pepper, I should, even after the many extraordinary things that I have witnessed, be inclined to imagine that it was but a gigantic dream. Then there is that dreadful dark nebula with its multitudes of red spheres, moving always within the shadow of the dark sun, sweeping along on its stupendous orbit, wrapped eternally in gloom. And the faces that peered out at me, God, do they, and does such a thing really exist? There is still that little heap of gray ash on my study floor. I will not have it touched. At times, when I am calmer, I have wondered what became of the outer planets of the solar system. It has occurred to me that they may have broken loose from the sun's attraction and whirled away into space. This is, of course, only a surmise. There are so many things about which I wonder. Now that I am writing, let me record that I am certain there is something horrible about to happen. Last night a thing occurred which has filled me with an even greater terror than did the pit fear. I will write it down now, and if anything more happens, endeavor to make a note of it at once. I have a feeling that there is more in this last affair than in all those others. I am shaky and nervous, even now as I write. Somehow I think death is not very far away. Not that I fear death, as death is understood. Yet there is that in the air which bids me fear, an intangible cold horror. I felt it last night. It was thus. Last night I was sitting here in my study writing. The door leading into the garden was half open. At times the metallic rattle of a dog's chain sounded faintly. It belongs to the dog I have bought since Pepper's death. I will not have him in the house, not after Pepper. Still, I have felt it better to have a dog about the place. They are wonderful creatures. I was much engrossed in my work, and the time passed quickly. Suddenly I heard a soft noise on the path outside in the garden. Pat, 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 it went with a stealthy, curious sound. I sat upright with a quick movement and looked out through the open door. Again the noise came. Pat, pat, pat. It appeared to be approaching. With a slight feeling of nervousness, I stared into the gardens, but the night hid everything. Then the dog gave a long howl, and I started. For a minute, perhaps, I peered intently, but could hear nothing. After a little, I picked up the pen which I had laid down and recommenced my work. The nervous feeling had gone, for I imagined that the sound I had heard was nothing more than the dog rocking round his kennel at the length of his chain. A quarter of an hour may have passed. Then all at once the dog howled again, and with such a plaintively sorrowful note that I jumped to my feet, dropping my pen and inking the page on which I was at work. "Curse that dog," I muttered, noting what I had done. Then, even as I said the words, there sounded again that queer pad, pad, pad. It was horribly close, almost by the door, I thought. I knew now that it could not be the dog. His chain would not allow him to come so near. The dog's growl came again, and I noted subconsciously the taint of fear in it. Outside on the window-sill I could see Tip, my sister's pet cat. As I looked, it sprang to its feet, its tail swelling visibly. For an instant it stood thus, seeming to stare fixedly at something in the direction of the door. Then quickly it began to back along the sill until, reaching the wall at the end, it could go no further. There it stood, rigid as though frozen, in an attitude of extraordinary terror. Frightened and puzzled, I seized a stick from the corner and went toward the door silently, taking one of the candles with me. I had come to within a few paces of it when suddenly
A peculiar sense of fear thrilled through me, a fear palpitant and real, whence I knew not nor why. So great was the feeling of terror that I wasted no time, but retreated straightway, walking backward and keeping my gaze fearfully on the door. I would have given much to rush at it, fling it to, and shoot the bolts, for I have had it repaired and strengthened so that now it is far stronger than ever it has been. Like Tip, I continued my almost unconscious progress backward until the wall brought me up. At that I started nervously and glanced round apprehensively. As I did so, my eyes dwelt momentarily on the rack of firearms, and I took a step toward them, but stopped with a curious feeling that they would be needless. Outside in the gardens, the dog moaned strangely. Suddenly from the cat there came a fierce long screech. I glanced jerkily in its direction. Something luminous and ghostly encircled it and grew upon my vision. It resolved into a glowing hand, transparent, with a lambent greenish flame flickering over it. The cat gave a last awful caterwaul, and I saw it smoke and blaze. My breath came with a gasp, and I leant against the wall. Over that part of the window there spread a smudge, green and fantastic. It hid the thing from me, though the glare of fire shone through dully. A stench of burning stole into the room. Pad, pad, pad. Something passed down the garden path, and a faint, moldy odor seemed to come in through the open door and mingle with the burnt smell. The dog had been silent for a few moments. Now I heard him yowl sharply, as though in pain. Then he was quiet, save for an occasional subdued whimper of fear. A minute went by. Then the gate on the west side of the gardens slammed distantly. After that, nothing. Not even the dog's whine. I must have stood there some minutes. Then a fragment of courage stole into my heart, and I made a frightened rush at the door, dashed it to, and bolted it. After that, for a full half hour, I sat helpless, staring before me rigidly. Slowly my life came back to me, and I made my way shakily upstairs to bed. That is all. End of chapter 24. Recording by John Van Stan, Savannah, Georgia. Chapter 25 of The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Thing from the Arena. This morning, early, I went through the gardens but found everything as usual. Near the door I examined the path for footprints yet here again. There was nothing to tell me whether or not I dreamed last night. It was only when I came to speak to the dog that I discovered tangible proof that something did happen. When I went to his kennel he kept inside, crouching up in one corner, and I had to coax him to get him out. When finally he consented to come it was in a strangely cowed and subdued manner. As I patted him, my attention was attracted to a greenish patch on his left flank. On examining it, I found that the fur and skin had been apparently burnt off, for the flesh showed raw and scorched. The shape of the mark was curious, reminding me of the imprint of a large talon or hand. I stood up thoughtful. My gaze wandered toward the study window. The rays of the rising sun shimmered on the smoky patch in the lower corner, causing it to fluctuate from green to red oddly. Ah, that was undoubtedly another proof, and suddenly the horrible thing I saw last night rose in my mind. I looked at the dog again. I knew the cause now of that hateful-looking wound on his side. I knew also that what I had seen last night had been a real happening. And a great discomfort filled me. Pepper, Tip, and now this poor animal. I glanced at the dog again and noticed that he was licking at his wound. Poor brute, I muttered, and bent to pat his head. At that he got up on his feet, nosing and licking my hand wistfully. Presently I left him, having other matters to which to attend. After dinner I went to see him again. He seemed quiet and disinclined to leave his kennel. From my sister I have learnt that he has refused all food today. She appeared a little puzzled when she told me, though quite unsuspicious of anything of which to be afraid. The day has passed uneventfully enough. After tea I went again to have a look at the dog. He seemed moody and somewhat restless, yet persisted in remaining in his kennel. Before locking up for the night, I moved his kennel out away from the wall, so that I shall be able to watch it from the small window tonight. The thought came to me to bring him into the house for the night, but consideration has decided me to let him remain out. I cannot say that this house is in any degree less to be feared than the gardens. Pepper was in the house, and yet... It is now 2 o'clock. Since 8 I have watched the kennel from the small side window in my study, yet nothing has occurred, and I am too tired to watch longer. I will go to bed. During the night I was restless. This is unusual for me, but toward morning I obtained a few hours' sleep. I rose early and after breakfast visited the dog. He was quiet, but morose, and refused to leave his kennel. I wish there was some horse doctor near here. I would have the poor brute looked to. All day he has taken no food, but has shown an evident desire for water, lapping it up greedily. I was relieved to observe this. The evening has come, and I am in my study. I intend to follow my plan of last night and watch the kennel. The door leading into the garden is bolted securely. I am consciously glad there are bars to the windows. Night. Midnight has gone. The dog has been silent up to the present. Through the side window on my left I can make out dimly the outlines of the kennel. For the first time, the dog moves, and I hear the rattle of his chain. I look out quickly. As I stare, the dog moves again restlessly, and I see a small patch of luminous light shine from the interior of the kennel. It vanishes. Then the dog stirs again, and once more the gleam comes. I am puzzled. The dog is quiet, and I can see the luminous thing plainly. It shows distinctly. There is something familiar about the shape of it. For a moment I wonder. Then it comes to me that it is not unlike the four fingers and thumb of a hand. Like a hand! And I remember the contour of that fearsome wound on the dog's side. It must be the wound I see. It is luminous at night. Why? The minutes pass. My mind is filled with this fresh thing. Suddenly I hear a sound out in the gardens. How it thrills through me! It is approaching. Pad, pad, pad. A prickly sensation traverses my spine and seems to creep across my scalp. The dog moves in his kennel and whimpers frightenedly. He must have turned round, for now I can no longer see the outline of his shining wound. Outside the gardens are silent once more, and I listen fearfully. A minute passes, and another. Then I hear the padding sound again. It is quite close, and appears to be coming down the graveled path. The noise is curiously measured and deliberate. It ceases outside the door, and I rise to my feet and stand motionless. From the door comes a slight sound. The latch is being slowly raised. A singing noise is in my ears, and I have a sense of pressure about the head. The latch drops with a sharp click into the catch. The noise startles me afresh, jarring horribly on my tense nerves. After that I stand for a long while amid an ever-growing quietness. All at once my knees begin to tremble, and I have to sit, quickly. An uncertain period of time passes, and gradually I begin to shake off the feeling of terror that has possessed me. Yet still I sit. I seem to have lost the power of movement. I am strangely tired and inclined to doze. My eyes open and close, and presently I find myself falling asleep and waking in fits and starts. It is some time later that I am sleepily aware that one of the candles is guttering. When I wake again it has gone out, and the room is very dim under the light of the one remaining flame. The semi-darkness troubles me little. I have lost that awful sense of dread, and my only desire seems to be to sleep. Sleep. Suddenly, although there is no noise, I am awake, wide awake. I am acutely conscious of the nearness of some mystery, of some overwhelming presence. The very air seems pregnant with terror. I sit huddled and just listen intently. Still there is no sound. Nature herself seems dead. Then the oppressive stillness is broken by a little eldritch scream of wind that sweeps round the house and dies away, remotely. I let my gaze wander across the half-lighted room. By the great clock in the far corner is a dark, tall shadow. For a short instant I stare frightenedly, then I see that it is nothing, and am momentarily relieved. In the time that follows, the thought flashes through my brain, why not leave this house of mystery and terror? Then, as though an answer, there sweeps up across my sight a vision of the wondrous sea of sleep. The sea of sleep where she and I have been allowed to meet after the years of separation and sorrow. And I know that I shall stay on here, whatever happens. Through the side window, I note the somber blackness of the night. My glance wanders away and round the room, resting on one shadowy object and another. Suddenly I turn and look at the window on my right. As I do so, I breathe quickly and bend forward with a frightened gaze at something outside the window, but close to the bars. I am looking at a vast, misty swine face, over which fluctuates a flamboyant flame of a greenish hue. It is the thing from the arena. The quivering mouth seems to drip with a continual phosphorescent slaver. The eyes are staring straight into the room with an inscrutable expression. Thus I sit rigidly, frozen. The thing has begun to move. It is turning slowly in my direction. Its face is coming round toward me. It sees me. Two huge, inhumanly human eyes are looking through the dimness at me. I am cold with fear. Yet even now I am keenly conscious and note, in an irrelevant way, that the distant stars are blotted out by the mass of the giant face. A fresh horror has come to me. I am rising from my chair without the least intention. I am on my feet, and something is impelling me toward the door that leads out into the gardens. I wish to stop, but cannot. Some immutable power is opposed to my will, and I go slowly forward, unwilling and resistant. My glance flies round the room helplessly and stops at the window. The great swine face has disappeared, and I hear again that stealthy pad, pad, pad. It stops outside the door toward which I am being compelled. There succeeds a short, intense silence. Then there comes a sound. It is the rattle of the latch being slowly lifted. At that I am filled with desperation. I will not go forward another step. I make a vast effort to return, but it is as though I press back upon an invisible wall. I groan out loud, and the agony of my fear and the sound of my voice is frightening. Again comes that rattle, and I shiver clammily. I fight and struggle to hold back, but it is of no use. I am at the door, and in a mechanical way I watch my hand go forward to undo the topmost bolt. It does so, entirely without my volition. Even as I reach up toward the bolt, the door is violently shaken, and I get a sickly whiff of moldy air, which seems to drive in through the interstices of the doorway. I draw the bolt back slowly, fighting dumbly the while. It comes out of its socket with a click, and I begin to shake aguishly. There are two more, one at the bottom of the door, the other, a massive affair, is placed about the middle. For perhaps a minute I stand with my arms hanging slackly by my sides. The influence to meddle with the fastenings of the door seems to have gone. All at once there comes the sudden rattle of iron at my feet. I glance down quickly and realize with an unspeakable terror that my foot is pushing back the lower bolt. An awful sense of helplessness assails me. The bolt comes out of its hole with a slight ringing sound, and I stagger on my feet,
grasping at the great central bolt for support. A minute passes, an eternity, then another. My God, help me! I am being forced to work upon the last fastening. I will not! Better to die than open to the terror that is on the other side of the door. Is there no escape? God help me! I have jerked the bolt half out of its socket. My lips emit a hoarse scream of terror. The bolt is three parts drawn now, and still my unconscious hands work toward my doom. Only a fraction of steel between my soul and that. Twice I scream out in the supreme agony of my fear. Then with a mad effort I tear my hands away. My eyes seem blinded. A great blackness is falling upon me. Nature has come to my rescue. I feel my knees giving. There is a loud, quick thudding upon the door, and I am falling, falling. I must have lain there at least a couple of hours. As I recover, I am aware that the other candle has burnt out, and the room is in an almost total darkness. I cannot rise to my feet, for I am cold and filled with a terrible cramp. Yet my brain is clear, and there is no longer the strain of that unholy influence. Cautiously, I get upon my knees and feel for the central bolt. I find it and push it securely back into its socket. Then the one at the bottom of the door. By this time, I am able to rise to my feet and so manage to secure the fastening at the top. After that, I go down upon my knees again and creep away among the furniture in the direction of the stairs. By doing this, I am safe from observation from the window. I reach the opposite door, and as I leave the study, cast one nervous glance over my shoulder toward the window. Out in the night, I seem to catch a glimpse of something impalpable, but it may be only a fancy. Then I am in the passage and on the stairs. Reaching my bedroom, I clamber into bed, all clothed as I am, and pull the bedclothes over me. There, after a while, I begin to regain a little confidence. It is impossible to sleep, but I am grateful for the added warmth of the bedclothes. Presently, I try to think over the happenings of the past night, but though I cannot sleep, I find that it is useless to attempt consecutive thought. My brain seems curiously blank. Toward morning, I begin to toss uneasily. I cannot rest, and after a while, I get out of bed and pace the floor. The wintry dawn is beginning to creep through the windows and shows the bare discomfort of the old room. Strange that, through all these years, it has never occurred to me how dismal the place really is. And so a time passes. From somewhere downstairs, a sound comes up to me. I go to the bedroom door and listen. It is Mary, bustling about the great old kitchen, getting the breakfast ready. I feel little interest. I am not hungry. My thoughts, however, continue to dwell upon her. How little the weird happenings in this house seem to trouble her. Except in the incident of the pit creatures, she has seemed unconscious of anything unusual occurring. She is old, like myself, yet how little we have to do with one another. Is it because we have nothing in common, or only that being old we care less for society than quietness? These and other matters pass through my mind as I meditate, and help to distract my attention for a while from the oppressive thoughts of the night. After a time, I go to the window, and opening it, look out. The sun is now above the horizon, and the air, though cold, is sweet and crisp. Gradually my brain clears, and a sense of security for the time being comes to me. Somewhat happier, I go downstairs and out into the garden to have a look at the dog. As I approach the kennel, I am greeted by the same moldy stench that assailed me at the door last night. Shaking off a momentary sense of fear, I call to the dog, but he takes no heed. And after calling once more, I throw a small stone into the kennel. At this, he moves uneasily, and I shout his name again, but do not go closer. Presently, my sister comes out and joins me in trying to coax him from the kennel. In a little the poor beast rises and shambles out, lurching queerly. In the daylight he stands swaying from side to side and blinking stupidly. I look and note that the horrid wound is larger, much larger, and seems to have a whitish fungoid appearance. My sister moves to fondle him, but I detain her, and explain that I think it will be better not to go too near him for a few days, as it is impossible to tell what may be the matter with him, and it is well to be cautious. A minute later she leaves me, coming back with a basin of odd scraps of food. This she places on the ground near the dog, and I push it into his reach, with the aid of a branch broken from one of the shrubs. Yet, though the meat should be tempting, he takes no notice of it, but retires to his kennel. There is still water in his drinking vessel, so after a few moments' talk, we go back to the house. I can see that my sister is much puzzled as to what is the matter with the animal, yet it would be madness even to hint the truth to her. The day slips away uneventfully, and night comes on. I have determined to repeat my experiment of last night. I cannot say that it is wisdom, yet my mind is made up. Still, however, I have taken precautions, for I have driven stout nails in at the back of each of the three bolts that secure the door opening from the study into the gardens. This will at least prevent a recurrence of the danger I ran last night. From 10 to about 2:30 I watch, but nothing occurs, and finally I stumble off to bed, where I am soon asleep. End of chapter 25. Recording by John Van Stand, Savannah, Georgia. Chapter 26 of The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Luminous Speck. I awake suddenly. It is still dark. I turn over once or twice in my endeavors to sleep again, but I cannot sleep. My head is aching slightly, and by turns I am hot and cold. In a little I give up the attempt and stretch out my hand for the matches. I will light my candle and read a while. Perhaps I shall be able to sleep after a time. For a few moments I grope, then my hand touches the box, but as I open it I am startled to see a phosphorescent speck of fire shining amid the darkness. I put out my other hand and touch it. It is on my wrist. With a feeling of vague alarm I strike a light hurriedly and look, but can see nothing save a tiny scratch. Fancy, I mutter with a half-sigh of relief. Then the match burns my finger and I drop it quickly. As I fumble for another, the thing shines out again. I know now that it is no fancy. This time I light the candle and examine the place more closely. There is a slight greenish discoloration round the scratch. I am puzzled and worried. Then a thought comes to me. I remember the morning after the thing appeared. I remember that the dog licked my hand. It was this one, with the scratch on it. Though I have not been even conscious of the abasement until now, a horrible fear has come to me. It creeps into my brain. The dog's wound shines at night. With a dazed feeling, I sit down on the side of the bed and try to think, but cannot. My brain seems numbed with the sheer horror of this new fear. Time moves on unheeded. Once I rouse up and try to persuade myself that I am mistaken, but it is no use. In my heart I have no doubt. Hour after hour I sit in the darkness and silence and shiver, hopelessly. The day has come and gone, and it is night again. This morning early I shot the dog and buried it away among the bushes. My sister is startled and frightened, but I am desperate. Besides, it is better so. The foul growth had almost hidden its left side, and the place on my wrist has enlarged perceptibly. Several times I have caught myself muttering prayers, little things learnt as a child. God, Almighty God, help me. I shall go mad. 6 days and I have eaten nothing. It is night, and I am sitting in my chair. Ah, God! I wonder, have any ever felt the horror of life that I have come to know? I am swathed in terror. I feel the ever-burning of this dread growth. It has covered all my right arm and side, and is beginning to creep up my neck. Tomorrow it will eat into my face. I shall become a terrible mass of living corruption. There is no escape. Yet a thought has come to me, born of a sight of the gun-rack on the other side of the room. I have looked again with the strangest of feelings. The thought grows upon me. God, thou knowest, thou must know that death is better, aye, better a thousand times than this. Jesus, forgive me, but I cannot live. Cannot. I dare not. I am beyond all hope. There is nothing else left. It will, at least, spare me that final horror. I think I must have been dozing. I am very weak and, oh, so miserable. So miserable and tired. The rustle of the paper tries my brain. My hearing seems preternaturally sharp. I will sit a while and think. Hush! I hear something. Down in the cellars. It is a creaking sound. My God! It is the opening of the great oak trap. What can be doing that? The scratching of my pen deafens me. I must listen. There are steps on the stairs. Strange padding steps that come up and nearer. Jesus, be merciful to me. An old man. There is something fumbling at the door handle. Oh, God, help me now. Jesus, the door is opening. Slowly. Something.
That is all. Author's footnote. From the unfinished word, it is possible, on the manuscript, to trace a faint line of ink which suggests that the pen has trailed away over the paper, possibly through fright and weakness. End of author's footnote. End of chapter 26. Recording by John Van Stan, Savannah, Georgia.
Chapter 27 of The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Conclusion.
I put down the manuscript and glanced across at Tonnison. He was sitting staring out into the dark. I waited a minute, then I spoke. Well? I said. He turned slowly and looked at me. His thoughts seemed to have gone out of him into a great distance. Was he mad? I asked, and indicated the manuscript with a half nod. Tonnison stared at me unseeingly a moment. Then his wits came back to him, and suddenly he comprehended my question.
No,
he said. I opened my lips to offer a contradictory opinion, for my sense of the saneness of things would not allow me to take the story literally. Then I shut them again without saying anything. Somehow the certainty in Tonnison's voice affected my doubts. I felt all at once less assured, though I was by no means convinced as yet. After a few moments' silence, Tonnison rose stiffly and began to undress. He seemed disinclined to talk, so I said nothing, but followed his example. I was weary, though still full of the story I had just read. Somehow, as I rolled into my blankets, there crept into my mind a memory of the old gardens as we had seen them. I remembered the odd fear that the place had conjured up in our hearts, and it grew upon me with conviction that Tonnison was right. It was very late when we rose. Nearly midday, for the greater part of the night had been spent in reading the manuscript. Tonnison was grumpy, and I felt out of sorts. It was a somewhat dismal day, and there was a touch of chilliness in the air. There was no mention of going out fishing on either of our parts. We got dinner, and after that just sat and smoked in silence. Presently Tonnison asked for the manuscript. I handed it to him, and he spent most of the afternoon in reading it through by himself. It was while he was thus employed that a thought came to me. "What do you say to having another look at?" I nodded my head downstream. Tonnison looked up.
"Nothing,"
he said abruptly, and somehow I was less annoyed than relieved at his answer. After that I left him alone. A little before tea time he looked up at me curiously.
"Sorry, old chap, if I was a bit short with you just now."
Just now, indeed. He had not spoken for the last 3 hours.
"But I would not go there again,"
and he indicated with his head, "for anything that you could offer me.
Ugh!"
And he put down that history of a man's terror and hope and despair. The next morning we rose early and went for our accustomed swim. We had partly shaken off the depression of the previous day, and so took our rods when we had finished breakfast and spent the day at our favorite sport. After that day we enjoyed our holiday to the utmost, though both of us looked forward to the time when our driver should come, for we were tremendously anxious to inquire of him, and through him among the people of the tiny hamlet, whether any of them could give us information about that strange garden, lying away by itself in the heart of an almost unknown tract of country. At last the day came on which we expected the driver to come across for us. He arrived early while we were still abed, and the first thing we knew he was at the opening of the tent inquiring whether we had had good sport. We replied in the affirmative, and then both together almost in the same breath. We asked the question that was uppermost in our minds. Did he know anything about an old garden and a great pit and a lake situated some miles away down the river? Also, had he ever heard of a great house thereabouts? No, he did not, and had not. Yet stay, he had heard a rumor, once upon a time, of a great old house standing alone out in the wilderness. But if he remembered rightly, it was a place given over to the fairies. Or if that had not been so, he was certain that there had been something queer about it. And anyway, he had heard nothing of it for a very long while, not since he was quite a gossoon. No, he could not remember anything particular about it. Indeed, he did not know he remembered anything at all, until we questioned him.
"Look here,"
said Tonnison, finding that this was about all that he could tell us.
"Just take a walk round the village while we dress, and find out something if you can."
With a nondescript salute, the man departed on his errand, while we made haste to get into our clothes, after which we began to prepare breakfast. We were just sitting down to it when he returned.
"It's all in bed with the lazy devils is, sir,"
he said with a repetition of the salute, and an appreciative eye to the good things spread out on our provision chest which we utilized as a table.
"Oh, well, sit down," replied my friend, "and have something to eat with us,"
which the man did without delay. After breakfast Tonnison sent him off again on the same errand while we sat and smoked. He was away some 3/4 of an hour, and when he returned it was evident that he had found out something. It appeared that he had got into conversation with an ancient man of the village who probably knew more, though it was little enough, of the strange house than any other person living. The substance of this knowledge was that in the ancient man's youth, and goodness knows how long back that was, there had stood a great house in the center of the gardens where now was left only that fragment of ruin. This house had been emptied for a great while, years before his, the ancient man's, birth. It was a place shunned by the people of the village as it had been shunned by their fathers before them. There were many things said about it, and all were of evil. No one ever went near it, either by day or night. In the village it was a synonym of all that is unholy and dreadful. And then one day a man, a stranger, had ridden through the village and turned off down the river in the direction of the house, as it was always termed by the villagers. Some hours afterwards he had ridden back, taking the track by which he had come toward Ardrahan. Then for 3 months or so nothing was heard.
At the end of that time he reappeared, but now he was accompanied by an elderly woman and a large number of donkeys laden with various articles. They had passed through the village without stopping and gone straight down the bank of the river in the direction of the house. Since that time, no one save the man whom they had chartered to bring over monthly supplies of necessaries from Ardrahan had ever seen either of them, and him none had ever induced to talk. Evidently he had been well paid for his trouble. The years had moved onward uneventfully enough in that little hamlet, the man making his monthly journeys regularly. One day he had appeared as usual on his customary errand. He had passed through the village without exchanging more than a surly nod with the inhabitants and gone on toward the house. Usually it was evening before he made the return journey. On this occasion, however, he had reappeared in the village a few hours later, in an extraordinary state of excitement, and with the astounding information that the house had disappeared bodily, and that a stupendous pit now yawned in the place where it had stood. This news, it appears, so excited the curiosity of the villagers that they overcame their fears and marched en masse to the place. There they found everything just as described by the carrier. This was all that we could learn. Of the author of the manuscript, who he was and whence he came, we shall never know. His identity is, as he seems to have desired, buried forever. That same day we left the lonely village of Crichton. We have never been there since. Sometimes in my dreams I see that enormous pit, surrounded as it is on all sides by wild trees and bushes, and the noise of the water rises upwards and blends, in my sleep, with other and lower noises, while over all hangs the eternal shroud of spray. End of chapter 27. Recording by John Van Stan, Savannah, Georgia.
Chapter 28 of The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Grief. Author's footnote. These stanzas I found in pencil, upon a piece of foolscap gummed in behind the flyleaf of the manuscript. They have all the appearance of having been written at an earlier date than the manuscript. End author's footnote. Fierce hunger reigns within my breast. I had not dreamt that this whole world, crushed in the hand of God, could yield such bitter essence of unrest, such pain as sorrow now hath hurled out of its dreadful heart unsealed. Each sobbing breath is but a cry. My heart strokes knell of agony, and my whole brain has but one thought, that never more through life shall I, save in the ache of memory, touch hands with thee who now art not. Through the whole void of night I search, so dumbly crying out to thee. But thou art not, and night's vast throne becomes in all stupendous church, with star bells knelling unto me, who in all space am most alone. And hungered, to the shore I creep, perchance some comfort waits on me, from the old sea's eternal heart. But lo, from all the solemn deep, far voices out of mystery seem questioning why we are apart. Wherever I go, I am alone, who once through thee had all the world. My breast is one whole raging pain, for that which was, and now is flown, into the blank where life is hurled, where all is not, nor is again. End of chapter 28. End of The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. Recording by John Van Stan, Savannah, Georgia. We'll be right back.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.